It's the most successful scientific theory in history. Who would dare say something as brave as that? No, not the orange fellow who calls himself a stable genius, but the physicist from Arizona, Adelaide and London, Dr. Paul Davies, who really is brilliant, as you'll hear, and whose new book is called Quantum 2. Quantum, now the centenary, and we're here to celebrate via our sister program. Yes, also on Radio National. Naked Scientists, and another dear friend, Naked's presenter in Cambridge, Chris Smith.
First, to give you a flavour for why the subject he studies even baffled Einstein, consider this. If you take a strip of paper and cut two vertical slits in it, side by side, and shine light through them, like waves washing into the entrances of a harbour, behind each slit, you see a pattern of rings. And where those rings overlap and the waves either add together or cancel out, you see bright or dark patches, respectively. So what happens if, instead of doing this with light waves, you instead use particles, like electrons or even whole atoms? Well, logic says that a particle would have to go through one or the other slit. It can't be in two places at once, so you wouldn't get that same pattern. But you do. In other words, the atom, or the electron, must have gone through both slits at the same time. Mustn't it? Yes, I warned you this was weird, but stay with me because it gets weirder still. Because if you measure which slit the particle went through, it was either just one or the other. And as soon as you turn that detector on to tell you that, the pattern vanishes. The particle knows you're watching it. Well, welcome to the world of quantum mechanics, a world inhabited by Arizona State University physicist Paul Davies. Paul was born in Finchley, North London, on the 22nd of April 1946. He attended Woodhouse Grammar School and read physics at University College London. From there, his career took him to Cambridge, to Adelaide and Sydney, and latterly, Arizona State University. Along the way, he has probed the origins of the universe, the quantum properties of black hole, and even the nature of time. Paul's written dozens of acclaimed science books. He's produced and presented hugely popular programmes for the BBC and other broadcasters, and his contributions to scientific research and communication have also been globally recognised. He's the recipient of the Templeton Prize, which has also been bestowed upon the likes of Mother Teresa, Dame Jane Goodall, and even the Dalai Lama, with whom Paul has worked in the past. And if that's not enough, Paul even has an asteroid named after him. I'm with him now at the BBC's new broadcasting house in London, not far from where it all began. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back in London, where I come from.
Well, tell us a bit about that intro and getting into science then. How did the story begin?
Very simple. It began in Charing Cross Hospital. I was born a physicist. I never wanted to do anything else. As a child, I was always fascinated by things unseen, looking up at the sky and imagining what might lie beyond what I could see, and then invisible fields, and, you know, anything that was sort of outside of the everyday experience fascinated me. And I suppose that's one reason I became interested in quantum physics. We can't see the weird goings on down at the atomic level.
Who lured you into the quantum realm, though, when you started getting into science at a higher level?
I don't think there was a specific lecturer at University College London. We, of course, had to learn quantum mechanics, I think, in years two and three. I found it inspirational but mystifying. It took a while to wrap my head around it, but I finally did, and it really became an important part of my research.
Niels Bohr allegedly said, if you're not baffled by it, you didn't understand it.
Well, you know, quantum mechanics is one of these peculiar things. It's the most successful scientific theory in history, and so it explains so much. In fact, the nature of matter all the way from subatomic particles up to stars, and it's given us dazzling technology, things like the laser, transistor and superconductors and MRI machines and quantum dots, high-definition televisions. You know, all these things around us are consequences of quantum physics, and yet deep down, when you actually take a look at it, it doesn't seem to make any sense. It describes a world in which there isn't like a single reality out there. We tend to think, look around us, see tables and chairs, that they really exist independently of us observing them. But when you get down to the atomic level, all that dissolves away, and it's simply not possible to say that a particle like an electron or even a whole atom really is in a certain place or it really is moving with a certain speed. You can look and see, and then what you find is an atom at a place or an atom with a speed, but it's not that our observations reveal or unveil a pre-existing reality. They somehow create that reality through the act of observation. So very mystical. I'm sounding very mystical, aren't I? But that is the standard so-called Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics due to Niels Bohr. And a lot of my colleagues just don't like that at all. And so this is a placeholder for some deeper way of trying to understand what is really going on in the subatomic realm, the quantum realm.
Where did the field actually come from? How did scientists realise there had to be something there that we need to delve into? In other words, when did it get started?
Well, the word quantum was coined by Max Planck, and he was investigating the nature of heat radiation. There was a puzzle in the late 19th century about if you have something like a kiln or an oven, it's got heat radiation trapped within it, and that has a certain spectrum, and nobody could quite understand the shape of that spectrum. It didn't seem to fit with the nature of electromagnetic waves. The other puzzle are atoms. We take atoms for granted these days, but in the 19th century, they were still very hypothetical. Nobody ever seen an atom. But when the electron was discovered, and after all, everyone's familiar with electricity, normal matter is not electrically charged, and so there have to be positive particles. And now we have this model of the atom with a sort of positively charged nucleus, electrons whizzing around it, and that's like a sort of planetary model. The big problem there is that when electrons accelerate, they emit radiation, electromagnetic radiation. That's how you get radio waves. You jiggle electrons up and down in antennae. There's probably one on the roof here. And that's how you transmit radio waves. So when an electron goes round and round in an atom, it ought to be blasting out very high frequency radiation for all it's worth. And then it would go into a death spiral. It would spiral into the nucleus and the atom would collapse in very short order. Clearly, atoms don't collapse. And so the stability of the atom was another big problem. And all of this fell into place when quantum mechanics was developed 100 years ago this year.
What sort of seminal experiments began to be done to show what people said was an extremely weird sector of science?
For me, the starting point of the serious putting together of this quantum mechanics were the experiments with what we might call matter waves. So it was understood that light and other electromagnetic radiation are waves, but it looked, and this was Einstein's idea, it looked that under certain circumstances it could behave more like particles. And we now talk about photons, like little particles of light. So is it a wave? Is it a particle? Nobody could quite make up their minds. But then the same thing happened in the 1920s with matter waves. So firing electrons, or now you can do it even with whole atoms, they have a wave-like character. But surely an electron is a little particle, and yet why does it behave sometimes like a wave? And so this was the starting point, trying to understand what were these matter waves, how could you interpret them? Because they're not like waves of stuff sloshing around. And the answer came in the mid-1920s. These waves, I liken them to crime waves. We talk about a crime wave passing through a city. You don't mean there's some criminality stuff sloshing about. What you mean is that there's an increased probability of a crime being committed. And that's the way we interpret the matter waves. Where the matter wave is strong, there is a greater chance that you will find the particle to be located if you look, if you do a measurement. And so that interpretation of matter waves really set the scene, because now it was possible to explain the stability of atoms, because the electron waves wrap around the atom in certain shapes and patterns, a bit like musical instruments. There are only certain notes that can be played in an instrument. So it's almost like the harmony that is taking place around the atom of these electron waves. And that explains all the energy levels and explains all the observations of spectra and other things. So it all fell into place.
One of the things we did when I was doing physics at school was to shine light waves through slits, and you could see that they form patterns of rings. And if you put the light waves through two slits, you see an overlapping pattern of rings where you get light patches and dark patches. Are you saying that matter particles, because I'm comfortable that how a light wave would do that, are you saying then if you did the same experiment with electrons, particles, I'd similarly see a pattern of rings then, and light and dark patches?
That's absolutely right. What you don't see is light and dark patches. What you can do is count the electrons where they arrive on an image screen, and they build up a pattern in a speckled sort of way. Each electron hits at a certain place, and when you have enough speckles, you see a pattern, just like you do with light. We call it an interference pattern because the waves going through one slit interfere with those going through the other slit. Now, that seems straightforward if we just think in terms of waves, but now what happens if you fire just one electron at a time?
Because that experiment's been done, hasn't it?
Oh, yes.
We've actually got to the stage where you can say, well, I'll send one electron through at a time. Because the hypothesis would be, if it's a particle, it can only be in one place at a time. If it's a wave, it can go through both slits. So if I fire just one, I should just see one spot in one place.
You're exactly right, and you can do the experiment, and you do fire them one at a time, and you do get a spot in one place. And so a single spot doesn't tell you anything. But when you've got a million spots, one at a time, that accumulated pattern shows the interference fringes. And you might think, well, why can't I just station some little device near the slits and figure out which slit it's going through? Because surely it can only go through one and not both. And if you do that, the pattern goes away.
So the electron knows you're watching?
Yes, sort of. It does seem very creepy. And you can do it with photons as well. And with photons, it's even more spectacular because you can send a photon through a slit system like that and then through a crystal that makes one photon split into two. And one of these photons can go to the image screen where you're going to record the pattern, or the other can go off to Albania or somewhere, and you can do a measurement on the Albanian photon that tells you which slit the photon went through. And when you do that, when you choose to make that measurement, you don't see the pattern.
So hang on a minute. I shine light through a slit and I put a crystal behind that splits the original photon into two. So I've got two new photons, one that goes to the screen that I'm watching, one that goes to a detector. If I don't have the detector turned on, I get a nice pattern as though there was no detector there, no crystal there, like the normal experiment. The minute I turn the detector on, it goes away.
Well, you have to interpret this very carefully. It's not the minute you turn the detector on. It's when you have recorded that information, when you go back and sit down with your accomplice in the lab saying, show me the results of your counting on the image screen, you see that there is a correlation, and that on the occasions when you got the information about which slit the photon went through, it doesn't contribute to the pattern, and vice versa. And it's even more creepy than that, because there's something called the quantum eraser experiment, where what you do is you get the information and potentially it's available to you, but then you erase it before you can inspect it. And under those circumstances, the interference pattern remains. These experiments have been done. This is not just some mystical mumbo-jumbo I'm talking about. This is real physics, and not only real physics, but physics which is now used in technology, because all of this stuff that we're talking about, and often a lot of it goes under the term entanglement, because the photon over here is entangled with the photon over there. This entanglement is the basis of a lot of what I call quantum 2.0, things like quantum computing and teleportation and the quantum internet, quantum cryptography. It uses this entanglement as a resource to be exploited. So you can monetize the weirdness of quantum physics, which initially, of course, was only investigated just to try and settle arguments about what is really going on in the quantum realm.
But Einstein was skeptical, wasn't he? He dubbed this spooky action at a distance, the photon knowing that you're measuring its counterpart and therefore erasing the information, the pattern. He was uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, Einstein didn't like quantum mechanics right from the outset. God does not play dice with the universe was a famous quote, because what we're talking about here is results which are probabilistic. I mentioned that earlier. These are statistical results, and he never liked the idea that nature is not fully determined down at the microscopic level. So he dreamt up an experiment in 1935, which we would now call entanglement, with two photons or two electrons, doesn't matter, that fly apart. And then you have two, you know, Alice and Bob, they're usually called, and they can perform measurements independently on their respective photons. But the key thing is they can change their minds at the last minute. So, you know, Alice and Bob might say, well, we'll measure the moment of each particle and we'll compare, or we'll measure the position or something like that and we'll compare. But Alice might say, no, I've changed my mind and I'll measure something else. And Einstein was of the opinion that that only made sense if the particles already possessed definite values of those quantities. But according to Niels Bohr, particles do not possess properties in advance of you measuring them. It's not fair to say that when you do the measurement, you're simply uncovering what already exists. Somehow you bring it into being. And Einstein hated that idea, and he called it spooky action at a distance. But the final point about this sort of Alice and Bob and opposite sides of the lab is those experiments have been done and in the 1980s, and Einstein got it wrong. It is, in fact, the case that the properties of the particles, what you choose to measure, are brought into existence by the act of measurement, and they're not already there from the get-go when the particles fly apart from the common centre. So somehow the experiment or the measurement is bringing into being the reality of these separated particles. It seems a bit like telepathy, and some people mistakenly think you can send information faster than light that way. You can't do that, but there is a correlation between these separated events that cannot be explained by saying that these particles had really existed in well-defined states prior to being measured. Schrödinger's cat was another way of illustrating the weirdness of quantum mechanics by saying, well, it's all very well down at the level of atoms and photons and so on, but at what point, when you consider larger and larger objects, do these quantum effects go away? And Schrödinger had this idea of incarcerating a cat in a box. I should say, for cat lovers, this is a thought experiment only. I'm told that Schrödinger did have a cat when he was living in Oxford called Milton. And the plan was, you put the cat in the box and there's a radioactive source and a vial of cyanide, a 50% chance that, say, after 1 minute, the source has decayed and triggered the hammer that smashed the cyanide and kills the cat. But if you seal the box, if you consider it a sort of totally isolated system, you have to conclude the cat is both alive and dead at the same time with a 50% probability. It's in a hybrid, it's an amalgam of alternative realities. You open the box and see, and then the quantum state collapses into either one or the other. But in the absence of the observation, it's an amalgam of both. And that just is a way of illustrating that surely somewhere between atom and cat, this theory breaks down. And yet many of my colleagues think it doesn't break down. They think it applies to the universe as a whole, and that the only way of making sense of Schrödinger's cat is to suppose that there are two universes, one with a live cat and one with a dead cat.
Classic stories and more from Dr. Paul Davies and Chris in 2 weeks' time after Easter on what quantum, that most successful theory ever, is achieving to change our lives.